This podcast is brought to you in part by the estate of Bob Nelson. Bob was a lover of all things San Diego and a longtime supporter of Voice of San Diego and its podcasts. We at Voice of San Diego are honored to have his support during his lifetime and continued support through his estate planning. Are you looking to engage with regional decision makers, business leaders, elected officials, and industry professionals committed to improving downtown San Diego? Join the Downtown San Diego Partnership. As a member, you'll receive access to exclusive resources, exposure to special programming, networking functions, and additional opportunities unmatched by any other local membership-based organization. Join the driving forces behind the future of downtown San Diego. For a 10% discount, become a member today.
Welcome to the Voice of San Diego podcast in partnership with News Radio 600 KOGO. I am Scott Lewis, the CEO and editor-in-chief at Voice of San Diego. Joined as always by Sarah Libby, our managing editor. Hello, Sarah.
Hey.
Andrew Keats is off once again. Couple more weeks of that. Hang in there. You can. Mayor Todd Gloria gave the first State of the City address of his new administration. We'll talk about the biggest takeaways we had and the kind of surprising dunks that he dropped on his predecessor. Unlike the state and school districts, which will be well-funded at their highest levels ever, the city of San Diego is going to have a very difficult time balancing its budget this year. We'll talk about the enormity of the city's financial problems and the new challenge city leaders will face with their employees' pensions. And then on the second half of the show, Associate Editor Jesse Marks is going to join to discuss his story about the city council buying surveillance gear on accident. Oops. Just accidentally bought some surveillance gear. It's a good one. Stay with us. Well, I don't know about you, Sarah, but my family sat around the dinner table last night with, you know, talking, cracking jokes about the day, getting our food. My daughter's a vegetarian now, apparently, so that's happened.
That's right.
And so we had our fake meatballs, and we had Todd Gloria at the dinner table with us. We wanted to watch the State of the City. My wife was into it, too. And so we sat with Todd Gloria, and my kids got to know Todd Gloria, and he gave his speech. And I got to say, I've never seen a speech like it. It was really interesting.
That sounds adorably old-timey, despite it being on Zoom.
Yeah, I got to say, we're probably one of the few families on Earth who watched it, especially while doing supper. But there's a few nerds out there who were probably doing that. I don't know.
Yeah, I was just doing the even worse version of it, which was reading Twitter reactions to it during dinner, which is well appreciated by your family.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. My wife loves it when I'm on Twitter during dinner. So that's what I actually missed out on. I didn't get anybody's reaction while I was watching because it was on my phone on the dinner table, and I kept wanting to look at reactions, but I couldn't get them. Now, what stood out for me, Sarah, was that kind of three things. One, it was kind of more real than a lot of speeches we've gotten in this forum over the years, as in, like, he really made an effort. And it's probably a little easier for him, too, as his first few weeks he's taken office, to be very clear about the city's problems so he can kind of create a breaking point. But he really listed the city's problems very clearly, and they were true problems.
Yes. I think my more cynical way of interpreting it is that it kind of took a once-in-a-century pandemic for literally any San Diego leader to say, like, things aren't 100% awesome.
Yeah.
But he did say that.
So yeah, he did.
There you go.
Here he was, for instance, talking about the budget deficit.
The pandemic has exacerbated long-standing city budget problems the last administration did too little to address. Behind the ribbon cuttings and news conferences, the city faced structural budget deficits. I've inherited a budget deficit that exceeds $150 million and will require difficult decisions to preserve neighborhood services. That hole in our budget is great.
I don't think people understand how big $150 million is. You know, we're going to talk about that in a little bit. But then the second thing that that clip really reveals as well is how many dunks Todd Gloria dropped on Kevin Faulkner, his predecessor, which it was my wife was even like struck by it, and she didn't particularly follow it that closely.
It was the first immediate thing that I noticed, especially because it was both like the hits came in like subtle and very specific, obvious ways. There was like the reference to the skydiving facility, which was like an obvious, specific priority of Kevin Faulkner's, but then also like more subtle references. You know, we're not just going to hold feel good press conferences, which is an obvious reference to Kevin Faulkner and a criticism that's been leveled at him many times.
And by the way, Todd Gloria's been to a lot of press conferences.
Yeah, I recently got several notices about some sort of bridge press conference. There is a bridge. There will soon be a bridge. So
some of them with Kevin Faulkner in particular. So here's where he said, you know, they all have this moment where it's like the state of the city is blank, and here is Todd Gloria's version of that.
Honestly, the state of our city is fragile right now, but I have faith that it won't be for much longer. You see, at the core, our city is strong because San Diegans are strong. We are resilient. We are fighters.
This was the capstone of that sort of real talk about how bad things were. And I took it, this is the perfect example of something I try to talk about a lot, is that there is, you can be vulnerable. You can talk about your problems in a way that's not disempowering, right? And in fact, it can enroll people in a more hopeful environment. In particular, I think it was a contrast to what Cindy Martin, the leader of the San Diego Unified School District, did a few weeks ago, where she outlined the district's situation and literally glossed over, you know, some major problems about equity, about quality, about kids falling behind, and was all bullish about it.
And since the state of San Diego Unified is always equal to the state of our students, the state of our district tonight is unstoppable. More than any generation.
And they both sort of have this underlying sentiment of like, you know, the constituency that they represent is strong and resilient. So even though things are terrible right now, you know, those people are good. But they definitely presented it in much, much different ways. And I think Cindy Martin caught a lot of heat for sort of, you know, glossing over this once in a lifetime impact on schools and families.
Yeah. And Todd Gloria like spent some time really dwelling in it. I mean, he just really tried to make it clear. I think he even got choked up when he was talking about the problems and how bad it's gotten, how his own father and his own partner have lost their jobs, like really trying to like communicate that he got that. Now, obviously, I think that it did have a lack of substance. Like, you know, there are these problems, like exactly what is he going to do about them? I'm not sure the state of the city is ever where they really lay out the substance. So it's still to come, but pretty good first start in that sense.
Yeah, I think the tone was surprising and refreshing for sure.
Well, there was, again, we mentioned there was some digs at Kevin Faulkner. Here was one that really stood out. Again, there's several real kind of eye-opening moments. We just don't see that very often in these settings. Here he dunked on the mayor's approach to homelessness.
No longer will San Diego be a place that buys indoor skydiving facilities that house no one and claim it will solve our crisis. And no longer will we expect our police officers to serve as the first point of contact for unsheltered people in need.
Do you think he does this, Sarah, if Kevin Faulkner is not running for governor right now based on his record in San Diego as mayor?
I think there's no universe in which that happens. It almost feels like he is harder on Kevin Faulkner than he ever was on Barbara Bree running against her.
Yeah.
And if you consider that, like, the last week or so of Faulkner's administration, they appeared together at a press conference, he and Todd Gloria, to talk about the convention center. And Kevin Faulkner, you know, sent him sort of a good luck message on Twitter that people thought was, you know, a really classy move to get all San Diego about it.
Well, so, I think Faulkner even endorsed him in a way in the campaign. You know, he was quoted saying positive things about him. He clearly preferred Gloria over Barbara Bree, who was running. And so, yeah, it's just a really striking example of how much things have changed in just the last few weeks since Faulkner has decided to become one of the primary critics of the governor, who is a very, you know, top ally of Todd Gloria.
Yes.
Let's just talk about this for a second. So Todd Gloria, along with a lot of Democratic leaders in the state, talked about the recall effort against the governor. It was a press conference organized by the Democratic Party, and it made us cringe a little bit how they handled it. So just to add some background, there is a recall effort going against Governor Newsom. They need to collect like 1.5 million signatures. By some accounts, they have almost half of them or more already in. They haven't even really spent the money to get signature gatherers, paid signature gatherers out. There's, because of the laws of how easy it is to get a governor on there, it seems like it's not that hard for them to get the recall onto the ballot if somebody wants to put in $1 million or $2, which might not be that hard to picture. So the governor's office is clearly watching this and clearly, I don't know, worried is the word, but they're certainly concerned. And this measure or this sort of effort was organized by the party to push back. Here was Todd Gloria speaking at that rally.
And so let us focus on what is necessary to defeat COVID-19, to get Californians back to work, to get our children back to school, and to focus on the many multiple challenges that are facing our state. The recall does not assist that. And those who are promulgating it, those who are advancing it, are doing it with the same motivations that we saw this past weekend, to overturn a Democratic election, to undermine the votes of millions of people, to sow discord, distrust, and disunity at a time when we need to come together as a state.
One thing I noticed about this line of attack is that they're kind of seizing on a lot of the Republicans' talking points in a way that they probably don't realize. You know, the first time around when the House impeached Donald Trump back at the beginning of 2020, a lot of Republicans said, oh, we don't need to do this, or we shouldn't do this because there's an election coming up in 10, 11 months. And that's really the only appropriate way to decide on whether a president should be in office. And of course, impeachment is a legally, constitutionally viable method to weigh in on those things. And it wasn't a very genuine line of attack. And now the Democrats are using it in the same way of, like, the recall is a legal process. And so, you know, the election of Gavin Newsom isn't the only way, you know, 2022, when he's up for re-election, isn't the only way that we have to address whether someone is in office or stays in office.
This was just bad and dumb. This was not a good way to handle this response. And it goes to the further extreme. Remember when Trump was being impeached the first time, they didn't just say that, you know, you should wait to the election. They also called it a coup. And when Gloria and others are embracing that type of language, they are not only wrong, like it's not that, but they're minimizing what happened last week, where there was an election that happened and then a violent effort to overturn it.
Yes, there are plenty, I think, valid criticisms of the recall attempt to be made by Democrats if they were inclined to do so. But, like, there's an election of a governor or a president that happens every 4 years. And then there's, like, a violent, hostile, illegal takeover. Those are two things. And then in the middle of those two things is a legal process by which you can remove someone in the meantime. And that's what we're talking about. And again, you cannot support the recall or impeachment. That's a thing you can do, but like to call it something it's not is just dumb.
Yeah, you can easily make the case. This is, you know, unprecedented challenge. We got, you know, all these things. This is only a couple years into his term. He's going to turn around. We got a lot of you're wrong about all these policies. You would lead things poorly. There's all kinds of ways to argue against this. But I also want to bring up Todd Gloria had himself a front row seat to the guy who had to resign his office in San Diego city government because he was facing a recall effort that Gloria and others supported to get him out of office. Sometimes people are in office and they need to be taken out.
Yeah. And I compared things to the first impeachment, but this impeachment that happened this week, one of the primary objections, and I think it's an incredibly disingenuous one, that Republicans like Daryl Issa have been trumpeting is that, you know, we need to heal and it's going to sow discord. And, you know, an impeachment does the opposite of that, although you could certainly have a bipartisan impeachment if they decided to go that route. And Todd Gloria is essentially saying the same thing, that the recall effort is divisive. Like, of course it's divisive. You're removing the leader of the state. That's the whole point.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Well, just to refresh people who maybe weren't paying attention as closely in 2003, if they get the signatures to put a recall on the ballot, it'll go into a vote. And it's like a two-stop vote. So you vote first, yes or no, on whether Gavin Newsom should be recalled. And then, even if you vote no, you choose who you would want to replace him. And that's, you know, that could be like between like 30 people. Remember the menagerie of candidates that popped up last
time? I sure do.
Oh, Gary Coleman. Remember Gary Coleman was running?
There was Gary Coleman. There was a porn star.
Yeah.
I would have to think this time around, like, Kevin Faulkner is going to be on the ballot next to, like, some TikTok influencer, probably.
Okay, let's talk about the city's budget situation for a minute. Todd Gloria put the budget deficit that they're going to have to close at $150 million or more. Our Lisa Halverstadt looked at it, said it's at least $124 million. Again, that's the difference between how much money they are set to spend versus how much they're bringing in. They have to close it. There's a law. They have to balance the books. City administrators asked police and fire departments to come up with 2% in cuts. A bunch of other departments are being asked for up to 4% in cuts. I think if you just took stood away from this situation and looked at $150 million in cuts is like 1,000 jobs.
That's a lot.
1,000 jobs is a lot of jobs. Now, they won't do that. They usually try to make these cuts by like cutting open positions, you know,
right.
That are
That's budgeted. Like the lowest hanging fruit always.
Right. Or you know, one-time funds that they can use to patch the deficit, which they could make a point this year and say, like, well, it looks like we're going to have a quick recovery, so it's not such a risky thing to do that. But something stood out for me of what Jay Goldstone, the COO that Todd Gloria put in charge of city operations, he said, our Lisa Halverstadt followed him this week, and he said, my understanding is that in the last couple of years, there's been over 100 and some positions eliminated out of the budget. So some of the low-hanging fruits probably not there this year. And so they might not have those easy selections. And I think one thing that stood out, there was only one city council member who mentioned this in their reaction to the State of City speech. That's Chris Kate, the kind of one of three or four senior members of the council who've been there for a while, who's like, this budget thing is going to be gnarly. He's the head of the budget committee. The rest of the council members didn't even mention it. I think they're in for a surprise. Yeah. I mean,
yeah,
I think that they're going
to be in that position. One thing that Lisa pointed out that I had sort of forgotten about is that 2016 ballot measure that like lockboxed infrastructure funds is just, you can just ignore it when you feel like it.
Yeah.
So that was one way they might, like you said, if they know that the economy is eventually going to rebound, they might be comfortable doing things like that where they consider them very temporary.
All right, there's three things I want to drive by on real quick here. One, there's a lot of talk, and Carl DeMaio really started to popularize this position, that the council members and the mayor have raised their salaries during this crisis. Let's just be clear. Voters voted on Measure L in 2018. And it wasn't perfectly illustrated just what that would do to their specific salaries, but it was very clear from all the reporting about it that their salaries would increase if they were tied to judges' salaries, however it was sort of benchmarked. So in 2018, that happened at 78% of the vote. So voters raised their salaries in 2018. If you hear that talking point out there, just understand that context.
Yeah, and Todd Gloria was not a city official at that point.
Yeah, had no role in putting that on the ballot. The second thing I want to address is this week we had, I did a story, was it this week? Was it last week? I don't remember.
What is time?
What is time?
The only certainty of time is that Carl DeMaio will be disingenuous about budget issues.
Yeah, so there was you remember Proposition B, another measure, 2012, it moved all new city employees except police officers into 401k style pensions instead of guaranteed pensions. Last year, the Supreme Court decided that it had been put on the ballot illegally as it should have gone first to the labor unions for negotiations because the mayor was leading it and he's the chief labor negotiator. This year, this week, last week, 2 weeks, whatever, judge decided that the Supreme Court ruling means that that law has to be fully taken out of city law, which, as I tried to explain in that story, means that the city is going to have to make whole the 4,000 or so employees who were hired after 2012. It doesn't necessarily mean that they have to give them a bunch of money because they did do well in the stock market with their 401ks. But they will be probably moved into a guaranteed pension system, and then new employees will probably go into something like that. It is an incredibly complex situation, and Gloria and the rest of the city is going to have to work that out.
I think you're right that like they have these gnarly issues coming up, both the budget and the pensions, which are of course tied together, and like doesn't seem like people are maybe grappling with that enough.
Well, and the third thing to keep in mind, I think there's going to be some hope at the city that they can get some of this pandemic cheese from the federal government to help rebuild. Now, the last stimulus did not include state and local support the way that they were hoping to kind of bail out these kinds of cities, which is ironic because it literally defunds the police then. and it was, you know, Republicans who didn't want to provide that support. And Democrats who did. And so there is hope, I think, at the city that the new round of negotiations for another relief package led by the Biden administration might provide that. But, you know, banking on that is not a good idea, it seems like. So there is a lot going on with the city budget, and you may not care about it. This deficit, though, is as big as the Parks and Rec Department. This is, you know, like if they were to just straight cut 1,000 positions, they might actually end up with actual layoffs in this situation. So you have all these council members that want to spend on equity and new departments and on homeless services and on homeless getting people off the street, but they have to do it with less resources, far less resources than they've had.
Yeah, and to tie up the state of the city discussion with the budget discussion and even talking with Jesse soon. One thing that struck me, you know, Todd Gloria has been pretty upfront about the fact that he doesn't support this push to defund the police in any way, but it is kind of wild to see these simultaneous discussions happening about police reform and defunding the police with a discussion about a need to cut millions of dollars from the city budget. And yet what's on the table is police and fire should each come up with equal 2% cuts, and that's not a thing we're discussing in any way with a Democratic mayor.
Yeah, yeah. All right, should we bring Jesse in? Well, this week, our Jesse Marks had a really interesting story. As one of its final acts in 2020, the outgoing San Diego City Council gave city employees permission to buy cell phone hacking technology, as well as drones and rapid response vehicles without realizing it. So this was pretty surprising story. I'd heard about it, but I read it with some awe, Jesse. So let's start first, before we really try to dig into the specific story, help us understand what it is. What's the agency involved? What's it called? And where does it come from?
Okay, so actually quite a lot of different agencies are involved in this, and it's kind of a bureaucratic maze. But I guess the way to really understand this, the structure of this organization, is that it's all housed under the San Diego County Unified Disaster Council, which is a joint powers authority. It's under the jurisdiction of the county. But the entity, crucially, that manages the distribution of the money that we're going to talk about in a second is the City of San Diego's Office of Homeland Security, which basically acts as a pass-through for federal Department of Homeland Security dollars that then come trickling down from the state into our region.
Okay.
So this involves neither San Diego Unified or the Department of Homeland Security, but it involves an agency called the San Diego Unified something and the City Department of Homeland Security.
Exactly.
Not at all confusing.
No, and at a certain point, you have to wonder whether the structure of the design of this process is intentionally meant to trip people up. And based on my conversations over the last couple of weeks, honestly, a lot of elected officials in the region didn't even know that this thing existed or how the process worked.
That's okay. Wild.
Okay, so what is it actually called again?
Well, so the name of the organization which divvies up the funds locally is the Urban Area Working Group. And they're part of a structure that's all under the umbrella of the Unified Disaster Council, which is managed by the city's Office of Homeland Security. Got it?
I think
totally.
Speaking for the podcast listeners out there, I think we got it. Basically, it is a group of people from all these different agencies acting together on behalf of the region to get money from Washington and use it to protect us. Is that the theory, the idea?
Yeah, that's the idea. Well, once every year, the Department of Homeland Security at the federal level divvies up anti-terrorism dollars for emergency preparedness or for natural disasters. And so the thinking and the goal is that this federal money will trickle down to the local level so that local agencies are prepared in cases of disaster and they're communicating with each other. They're sharing communications and technology, and they have essentially in place an infrastructure in case there is a disaster. So the point of the money is that everyone's on the same page, they're sharing gear with each other, and they're sharing information with each other. But how it gets divvied up is very convoluted. The group I mentioned a second ago, which is the Urban Area Working Group, that's made up of law enforcement personnel, mostly police and fire, from every one of the 18 cities in San Diego County, plus a representative from San Diego County. And so what they do every single year is they put together a wish list of the equipment and the projects that they want to actually spend this money on. But then they need to give it to the City of San Diego, which then actually applies for the money. So there's a process involved. It begins at the local level with local reps. They give it to the city, and then the city has to go apply for the federal funding. But before they do that, they have to get the city council to weigh in and buy off on the application before they can even file it.
This is where I think we get to like the two interesting takeaways from your story, because you got your hands on that wish list and revealed for the first time what some of this gear actually is that we're talking about, and some of it is controversial stuff. And the fact that the council signed off on it without airing that wish list or discussing any of those, you know, pieces of equipment or priorities in any sort of public forum, which is part of this pattern that you've been reporting on for a long time of like these policing issues, gear, strategy, surveillance equipment goes before the council, whether it's smart streetlights or something else. And it's just kind of rubber stamped. And we never talk about these like privacy implications and whether we really want this to be our priority and why. There's no like public airing of why we're doing this and what the risks and benefits are.
Yeah, that's true. Every single year, this grant application is rubber stamped. I think that's a good way of putting it. Even though some of the individual council members over the years have had issues with this process, nobody has pushed back very hard against it. when it came up in December and the Homeland Security staff at the city came to the council and said, we want to file another one of these, there was zero discussion on it. Nobody asked any questions. Whereas the year before, when it came up, Councilwoman Monica Montgomery Stepp questioned what actually this money would entail, where it would go and how it was going to be spent. And at the time, she said that she had seen a similar wish list herself and wasn't comfortable with some of the items on there. All of those criticisms that were raised in 2019 appear to have dissipated in 2020, and they just pushed this through without any feedback at all.
It was really interesting. You also talked to Georgette Gomez, who this was probably one of the final things she signed off on as a member of the council. And she sort of described to you like frustration with this, what she described as pressure from Kevin Faulkner's office to just sign off on this. It gets dropped in your lap at the last minute and you either sign off on it and risk, you know, exposing the county to being unprepared for a disaster, or, you know, there's no time to have a public airing of it.
And that's a pretty common thing that I've heard while I've reported out a lot of these stories. It came up with the smart street lights a couple of years ago as well. I remember Councilman Scott Sherman at the time said, you know, this is all part of a culture at City Hall, which drops things on you last minute. And then you're not really allowed to ask questions. Or if you do, you're considered to be a troublemaker. So you just push it through. And in this case, what happened was staff within the mayor's office, according to Georgette Gomez, had said, yes, we understand that this is coming to you last minute, but we cannot delay it any further because the city needs to approve the grant application before other cities and the county can get their gear. So if you hold this up for your city, you're going to ruin it for everyone else.
Of course, that's like a convenient explanation for a city council person, but it does seem to be kind of like a bipartisan sentiment that's shared among some of those members of the council. I guess I don't really understand why they couldn't at least have a discussion about it. I mean, if you're having a meeting to approve it, couldn't you say, like, here's what some of the gear is? I mean, they declined to even make that public, which is a whole other issue.
Yeah, there's a couple things to consider there. One, the urban area working group, which again is made up of local police and fire, they don't actually get together to approve the wish list until typically late December of every year. And so when this thing gets dropped into the lap of the city council a couple of days before that, there really isn't much time to get this rolling. I guess the real issue is why they don't bring this to the city council maybe several weeks or even a couple of months in advance, right? There seems to be an easy way around this, which is that if you don't feel like you have much time, then why don't you just schedule it earlier every year? And I was posing that question to people, and what I kept coming back away with was, I think, very reasonable perception that the law enforcement entities and representatives who are pushing this gear just don't want to actually talk about it. They've literally exempted themselves from disclosures, and they've done it in a couple of different ways.
Well,
one,
they've argued that they're
yeah, exactly. So what they argue is that they're exempt from the Brown Act, which is a state law that requires public agencies to hold open, accessible meetings. They've just said we don't have to do that, and we've exempted ourselves from it. There's a lawsuit now that's going to challenge that claim in court. And then the other thing they've done is they've said everything we produce for the purposes of putting these grant applications together, They're not public records. We've decided they're not public records, and they've cited a couple of different exemptions in the state law. And so that's also going to be challenged within the next few weeks. But basically what they're citing are state exemptions allowing agencies to withhold information if it's about, say, critical infrastructure or if it's about terrorist vulnerabilities. But there's absolutely no way that everything this organization produces falls under those two categories. I mean, you're going to argue to me that like even their emails and text messages back and forth to each other rise to the level of being threat assessments by terrorists. I seriously doubt it.
Help me understand, Jesse, what was the actual equipment? What would it be used for? And did they get it or are they getting it?
Well, so the grant application this year has been temporarily delayed because a lawsuit was filed a couple of weeks ago by Corey Briggs, a local attorney, and he filed it on behalf of La Prensa, which is a local newspaper, which was actually the first outlet to kind of dig into this last month. What's on the list, though, it's a wide range of things. It's everything from the benign radios, basic fire equipment, to things like bomb robots, rapid response vehicles. There's a lot of money in there set aside to actually pay for the staff, which does Homeland Security related work within the region. There's a lot of training in there. The vast majority of the stuff and the money in there is actually for communication systems and that type of infrastructure, as well as the staffing. But the stuff that really stood out to me was the services with Palantir. It's a company that's very controversial. It was founded by Peter Thiel, who's a Silicon Valley venture capitalist. And what his company does is it collates together different streams of data and then helps police make predictions based on that data. We don't really know how local police departments are using predictive policing methods. We just know that it's there and that it exists and that it's accessible to them. And then the other thing that really stood out to me was a contract with a company called Celebrite, which allows first responders, cops, firefighters to hack into encrypted and locked devices. So basically cell phones, to get information out of there that they may want that is connected to an investigation. And what Celebrite excels in is giving first responders the opportunity to do that while still out in the field. So they can take your phone and then they can just download the material off of it.
Without a warrant.
Without a warrant, which is key to this conversation. And so, you know, over the last couple of years, we've had these debates about when the city council should be aware of the surveillance capabilities and gear within the possession of local law enforcement. And so, and in the works right now is an ordinance requiring the city council to take privacy into consideration and to weigh the security capabilities of the various pieces of technology that they own. And yet, here you go. Here's an example of the city council just buying surveillance gear without even realizing it. Not even that there's no conversation taking place. They didn't even know that they were doing this. And they didn't know they were doing this because, one, they didn't ask questions. And two, because the process was completely kept in the dark. And they were told that they couldn't have any additional information on it.
And like with any of this equipment that we're talking about, whether it's smart streetlights or stuff that can hack into your phone without a warrant, maybe there's a case to be made that it's wholly good and we want it, or that it's sort of good and we want it in certain situations, but we're just never having that conversation in public.
Yeah, I think that's completely fair as well. And I've had this conversation over and over and over again with various city council members over the years, even those who've said, look, we don't think surveillance is categorically a bad thing for society. We actually are in favor of putting streetlight cameras all across the city. We disagree with the way that this went down because it was sneaky and we didn't know about it. And now we have to deal with it. And it's grown in a way that we're uncomfortable with. So we would have actually probably signed off on the original technology, but because you brought it forward in a way that kept us intentionally in the dark, that's the problem. And if they're in the dark, then the rest of the public is in the dark. So who knows what else? We don't even know what else the police department, even say the IT department, I mean, just the various levels of government and bureaucracy, we don't have a full vetting or account of everything that's in their possession just yet. And so that's where the conversation is moving at the city council level. And if this surveillance ordinance does get passed, it's going to force that every year, and it's going to force those conversations, and it's going to force those lists to come out. And we don't, I mean, hopefully I'm the first person to receive that list. And so I look forward to reporting on that.
I guess that just leads to the last point. I mean, what happens now? What are we looking forward to? Is there any movement to change how this works, or what are the next steps?
Councilwoman Montgomery Stapp, she is in charge of the Public Safety and Livable Neighborhoods Committee. She was the one, again, in 2019 who started raising questions about this process. Even though she voted in favor of the grant application in December, she has said She wants a full analysis of where this money has gone, where it's going to go in the future. And so she is going to make it, she says she is going to make it a point of conversation at the committee that she controls. So I guess going forward, we're going to have to keep an eye on that.
Jesse Marks, you can read his story at voicesandiego.org. Thank you so much. Great reporting. And maybe we'll let you back on the podcast again sometime.
You would be so lucky.
Very popular podcast. So, all right. Thanks, Jesse.
Later.
Thanks for listening to the Voice of San Diego podcast, the most popular public affairs podcast in San Diego. This week, look in the feed and you'll see a special episode. I've recorded an interview with Travis View, who is one of the co-hosts of the QAnon Anonymous podcast, where they've followed this conspiracy theory of conspiracy theories for many years now, and he has some great insight on what led the woman from Ocean Beach to become one of the many who attacked the Capitol and ended up paying for it with her life. Keep up with all of our stories and the most important San Diego news with the Morning Report. It goes out every weekday. Subscribe at vosd.org/morning. Again, you can check out that special episode in the feed. I'm Scott Lewis, CEO and editor-in-chief. Sarah Libby's managing editor. And this show is expertly produced by Nate John. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.